This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
I would love to introduce my guest today. Ilka Tampke is an award-winning author, an academic and teacher, in fact, my teacher. She is the author of the acclaimed historical novels Skin and Song Woman and joins us today to discuss her powerful new novel, How to Love the World. Welcome, Ilka.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
The novel begins with a dramatic event. Nalika is trapped beneath a falling manigam branch in the forest, and you capture this sense of claustrophobia so well, like a thriller. What drew you to that premise as a starting point to the story?
The forest is what drew me to the premise of the novel. So this idea of it being a thriller or having this sort of survival question, this urgency, that was not an intentional thing for me at all when I came up with the idea. It was much more philosophical. It was much more meditative. I was walking in the forest, as I do a lot.
I remember that from when you were a teacher, you used to talk about
that. Do you?
Yes, I do remember
that.
Yeah.
So interesting.
So I can remember. So this completely makes sense. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, so I've been banging on about it for a long time. And I was thinking about something that does preoccupy me a lot as a writer and as a human, which is belonging and connection to place. I live in the country, so I do live near a big forest area. I walk there a lot. I think about it a lot. And on this particular day, I was thinking about that, and it occurred to me, I was writing a different novel at the time, and it occurred to me that I could write a novel where a character was somehow held in place for a long period of time, you know, a whole day or longer, and given the opportunity to think about where they were and what they could really see. Mm. So it was that encounter with the forest that was the genesis of the idea. It wasn't this sense of will she, won't she make it, although I did think pretty quickly that would raise an interesting story question.
And it does. It's very compelling. And you use this as a sort of a scaffold to interweave other components of the protagonist's history, I guess.
Mm.
So it's a very strong structure. Would you mind just reading that first little bit for us, that so the audience can sort of hear what we're talking about?
For sure. So the central timeline of the novel is time-stamped. So we start on the 28th of February, 9:13 a.m. Belly down, cheek jammed against dirt, trunks horizontal, the track's edge a disorienting vertical, she had opened her eyes to the world on its side. There was grit in her mouth. The air was blurry with dust that had plumed in the impact. She'd been struck from behind. Someone was holding her down with a knee on her spine. But except for Louis, sniffing anxiously near her face, she was alone. She scanned herself frantically. Am I hurt? Can I move? What just happened? It took her several seconds to piece it together. The cannon fire boom, she'd thought it was thunder, the blow to her shoulders, the slam of her body against the earth. Now the iron weight across her back. Her breath raced with shock, with the sudden urge to sob. The blow had been so violent, so angry. Stop it, she told herself. It's not an attack. It's an accident, a fallen branch. She did not feel pain, at least not yet, just the smarting on her skin where the limb had hit her and an odd loosening in her lower skeleton, a sensation that her body was soaking into the ground. Louis whimpered, confused by this pause and his mistress's odd position. Nalika reached up with her left hand. Her right was wedged tightly under her body and stroked his chest as he panted furiously. From this vantage, she could see the ridges on the roof of his mouth and the floppy black labial tissue that hung around it. It's okay, she murmured as he dipped his snout to lick her cheek. We won't be here long. She couldn't tell what her injuries might be or if she was even injured at all, although now she was becoming aware of a deep ache in her spine. It could just be shock that held her legs so inert. She was pinned, she knew that. The limb lay across her middle back, its enormous heft pressing her chest into the ground. The pressure was far greater on her right shoulder, and there was no way she could free that arm, already numb beneath her. Her left arm she could move easily. She used it to brace herself as she slowly turned her head to face the right, which she could also do without pain. Ah, there were her keys, about a metre away, glinting in the leaf litter. But her phone, stupid, stupid woman, remained on the passenger seat of her car. She never took it into the forest, hated its intrusion. What an idiot she was. She had no water, of course. She hadn't planned to be long. She would be okay for a few hours until she was found, but what about Louis? He was a lab. He drank litres and litres and was already panting heavily. And what about her students? If she got free in time, she might still make it to class this afternoon. Only after these spinning thoughts did Nelica begin to understand that she was in an agony so profound that she was not breathing. The branch held her by the shoulder blades, but the greatest pain was in her lower spine and pelvis. It must have landed on her hips, then shunted forward after the first impact. She took tiny, shallow gasps of air. The limb seemed to drop a little further every time she exhaled, so that it was just slightly more difficult to take the next breath. Think, Nelica, think.
Thank you. So, as we can hear from this setup, Nelica spends much of the book physically immobilised, yet the novel feels emotionally expansive. How did you sustain momentum and tension within those constraints?
So the setup is we're with Nelica for this day, mm-hmm. and we track through minute by minute, hour by hour. But the substance of the novel is what happens in her consciousness over that time. So we go back to her early childhood. We go back to the immediate past, the morning as she was taking the walk that led her to this point. And then we go back to her current family life with her own two children. And what she's grappling with in that, in those thoughts and in those memories is a kind of moral reckoning. And as the possibility of her being found becomes less and less, and the possibility of her perhaps not surviving becomes, you know, greater and greater, that moral reckoning takes on more urgency and importance. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I taught you narrative structure, Lisa, at RMIT. You know, there are very clear theoretical, you know, theories and formulas, if you like, for narrative tension. And I don't adhere to them unwaveringly, but they tick along in my mind. So I often think about the midpoint of a story. When does the character reach the point of no return? What does that look like to shift, for something profound to shift in in a story's centre? So I thought about those sorts of ideas. But I think I said this to you just when we were talking before. I didn't know if it would work. I really didn't. I was really just writing. This is my third novel, third published novel, and it is just far and away the most intuitively written novel I've ever, you know, it was really, basically I wrote it by walking. I spent 1 year, it took me 4 years to write. One of those years I made this little deal with myself to walk in the forest every day and to use whatever came into my mind as I walked in the creation of the book. So it kind of unspooled in a kind of ecological way.
Yeah, there's a real enmeshing of this sort of nature and ecology with our own sort of history and background and the character's own personal background as well. Excuse me. Not only the grandmother, the mother, And there was this moment, sorry, I'm diverting, where she steps back. She imagines stepping back into the shoes of her mother and sort of empathetically taking on the world that her mother inhabited, and then does the same thing for her grandmother. And that's very much a theme, isn't it, in this book, this sort of heritage, I guess, and all of the history that family provides us. Like the story, our story starts not with a birth, but, you know, two generations before the birth. Was this something that was very conscious?
Yes, this really was. So I guess what we're talking about is ancestry. And ancestry, so I have I'm sort of greatly privileged to have a tangent of my life that is connected to West Arnhem Land. My partner works for an Indigenous organisation up there, and I've had a long-standing interest in First Nations philosophy. I probably talked about that when I was teaching. But, I have this opportunity to talk with a lot of First Nations people from community about some of these ideas. And ancestry is so big in First Nations culture. It's so powerful. It's so meaningful. It's such a profound component of identity in, you know, in the culture, you know, in the contemporary modern West. Ancestry's not really a thing. It's not, I mean, it's still a need, and I think we see that need being played out in this strange new obsession we have with, you know, ancestry.com and doing that DNA testing. But really, in terms of cultural practices, it's not, you know, we very much have a sense of our lives as being contained within the duration of our birth to our death. But in other cultures, people are multi-generational beings. And when I did that exercise that you talked about, it was actually an exercise that I myself did as part of a retreat in Bali,
stepping
back through ancestors. It's really quite powerful.
It's something that, as you say, as white Westerners, we really spend very little time considering. And, you know, the Indigenous population would have had much stronger connection to their heritage and also to the earth. We're going to have to, unfortunately, I've only started, it's only the tip of the iceberg with this novel, but unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up. But thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
I need to get you on again to talk about it in more detail. Thank you so much for being my guest. The title of this book is How to Love the World. The author, Ilka Tampke, and the publisher is Summit Books or Simon & Schuster.
Thank you, Lisa. Now, the novel I have today is entitled The Informant by Christine Gregory, but there seems to be a degree of conjecture about who is informing on whom. So, Christine, welcome to 3CR. Now, Silas Zaccone, or Zaccone, is murdered. He seems to be a nasty piece of work. How did you create him?
I mean, he was pretty fun to create. Like, he's a bit of a caricature. He's the head of the local chapter of an outlaw motorcycle gang. I mean, this story is not really Silas's story, so it's the event that kicks things off.
Well, his murder.
Actually, the story tends to focus a bit more on his son, Anton, but, he's a pretty nasty piece of work.
But there's somebody with him when he is killed, and she rings, and it's another contact. And so this sets off this notion of, was he informed on what has been going on, which is then what the novel sets out to find out about. We've got Silas's girlfriend, Ashley. Now, she's in an interesting situation. What's her background? Why is she with a married man?
So just to correct that, I don't think Silas is a married man. So
he's divorced his wife.
Yeah, his ex-wife appears in the book.
Well, she still thinks Silas is her property.
Yeah, she's the father of his son, who is set to take over upon his death. So she's the matriarchal figure that I guess, if you were a fan of any of the Underbelly series, there's a few women that you could easily model Rosa on. But, Ashley is has got herself in a situation where she can't really stay where she is, but she can't go either. And those around Silas don't trust her. They are questioning what her motives are. And then she's carrying a big secret as well. And so the strapline of the book is sort of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And Ashley, being his girlfriend, holds quite a lot of knowledge.
And is in a very precarious situation. Mm. But she's also then got to protect her son.
Yes.
Who's in danger. We have the good guys. And for all the bad guys, we've got to have some good guys. But are they that good, which is the question. Now, we've got Sergeant Davis, and he seems to have extricated himself from the city and gone to the country in some ways. He's trying to get away from...
No, he's grown up. He's a country boy who's born and bred. Mm. He did have a stint in the city at some point, but what he's done is he's moved from a very local small police station in Hopeville, which is his hometown, to a bigger regional centre in Coolum. And he's still struggling to deal with that shift where he was the one man in charge and now he has to answer to...
But he's got a very understanding wife in Pam.
Yes.
But now, there's a bit of a problem here because he initially starts to look into this death on the road, roadside murder, shots fired, all sorts of things. But there are people that have been put over him in this investigation. How reliable are they? We've got Detective Hicks, who's basically described as useless, and Detective Andrew Fuller. Now, there's something going on here. Why would you want incompetent detectives looking into a murder?
Yeah, I mean, the whole setup of this book is to have the reader questioning who is good here and who is not. And there are four different point of view characters in my book. They are providing different perspectives all throughout the novel. So the reader's sort of one step ahead in terms of seeing maybe from different perspectives what the police investigators aren't seeing and vice versa. So it creates that tension and doubt on all of these characters and their motives.
But there's a level of suspicion about Fuller, about Hicks, given that Silas was in fact running drugs and was expecting a rather large consignment to arrive.
So Fuller and Hicks are sent there from the city. They come from the serious crime, organised crime unit. And the rumours have been for many years that this Detective Fuller is bent and that he has been involved in some corruption cases in the past.
And he's also taken the credit for a previous investigation, which wasn't really...
He's to take credit for, yeah.
And you've mentioned another narrative thread. We've got Lars Nielsen. Now, what's his background?
So Lars is the character who's the consistent protagonist from my first book, The Community, which The Informant is a follow-on from that book. It can be read as a standalone, but there are some of the same characters. So Lars' background is in investigative journalism and he's writing a book on outlaw motorcycle gangs. So he's the perfect person to be reporting on this case.
But he doesn't want to be there.
No, he's sort of been corralled into it by his ex-boss who's convinced him that this is the story of a lifetime, this will make your career and it'll bring it back.
Will bring back the career because he'd lost... Yeah. How did he lose... his job, well, lose his job, be sent to the regions.
So, like, if you go back to read my first book, the premise there did start with Lars, who has been sort of exiled from his previous role, which was a senior reporter in a major newspaper, because he somehow got himself sort of named in a case of the murder of two detectives who were actually had infiltrated an outlaw motorcycle gang, and there were questions about whether Lars knew more than he had let on in those cases.
But he didn't want to give away the name of his informant.
He didn't want to give away the name of his informant because it would have compromised that person. Yeah.
So we've got people informing on all sorts of levels and influencing people's lives, etc. Just while we're on it, we've got a whole array of other disreputable and unsavoury characters. Sammy Lewis?
Yeah, so Sammy is the head of the rival gang. So the undercurrent in this book is to solve, I guess the drive for the police is to solve this case before it turns into an all-out bikie war, because when a bikie is murdered, questions are immediately asked about whether or not it is the rival gang who are involved in this. I mean, that's the most obvious answer initially.
So there's a suspect. Mick Grant?
Yeah, so Mick's an insider and one of Silas's friends. And so question was whether or not he's plotting against him.
Yeah. Gary Shepherd?
Yeah, another local nasty from the first book who's got his own axe to grind.
But Silas had basically taken his wife, was that?
No, that's the rival, Sammy, they shared a girlfriend. No, Gary's an associate, so not a patched member in the motorcycle gang, but was sort of a bit of a hanger-on.
But these were all boys at school.
They were all boys at school together, and even Sergeant Davis knew these boys from back in their school days.
And Anton, Silas's son, a bit of a sociopath.
Oh, even worse than his father, like a complete sociopath.
Could we put him under suspicion for perhaps?
The question is asked. It's quite doubtful, but it's anyone's guess early on in this case.
So it's all of these characters in the mix, but as you've already mentioned, there are four narrative strands. What's interesting is you start with three. You've got Davis, Ashley and Lars telling their story. By the time we get to part two of the novel, we've got another strand fuller. What are you trying to... Well, you've partly answered this question in terms of tension, but that part two, when Fuller comes in, comes as a bit of a shock.
Yeah, that came later on. He was a character who was in my first book but a little bit peripheral, and I decided that it was going to be important to actually bring in his point of view for the reader to get a closer insight into the psychology behind his behaviour, and it just added another layer of complexity to this character who could come across on the page as being a bit too one-dimensional, like, oh, he's not a good guy. And then you see another side to him and start to understand that he's a lot more complicated than he first appears.
But with informants, there's also a code of silence in a lot of professions. And towards the end of the novel, you actually flip this notion of informant, because the police are investigating a shooting which involved police shooting somebody, and it's Davis who has a chance to comment on Fuller, and here we have it. Did Detective Fuller consult with you about this plan? What do you mean consult? Did he tell you that he planned to confront the offender? He's the senior officer. He had the authority to give orders. Is that a yes or a no? I don't recall a discussion. There wasn't much time. Like I said, Detective Fuller had the authority. You're an experienced police officer, are you not, Sergeant Davis? More than 30 years in the force? Yes. And you still believe that your actions were the wisest course given the volatility and mental state of Anton Zakone at the time? Oh, it's easy to say what's the wisest course in hindsight, not so much when you're in the moment and there is a risk that two innocent people are about to be burnt to death. The team exchanged looks. Did Detective Fuller issue a warning to Anton Zakone before firing his weapon? I don't know. You don't know. I was at the front of the house at the time, and Detective Fuller was outside at the bottom of the steps. I couldn't see him, and the stun grenade had gone off moments earlier. My ears were ringing, and there was shouting, so I couldn't make out what was said. But he told you that he issued a warning. I can't recall. You can't recall. That's what I said. But you heard the shot. Yes, I heard. I think it was two shots in quick succession. And did you believe Detective Fuller when he said the shot from his weapon was fired in self-defence? I have no reason not to believe Detective Fuller. Is it possible that the shots were not in self-defence? I'm sorry? No bullets had been discharged from Anton Zaccone's weapon. There were two shots fired from Detective Fuller's weapon. Therefore, it is reasonable to suggest that he had not, in fact, fired his weapon in self-defence. It is possible. However, I believe that Detective Fuller was in genuine fear for his life at that moment. Now, here we have Davis, who now has the opportunity to actually reveal what he knows about Fuller. But it's as if the code of silence, the professional code of silence, is at play here.
Yeah, Davis is a bit of a contradictory character because he is a good guy through and through in terms of, in fact, counselling sort of younger police officers about avoiding that what they call that the blue wall of silence. But when he is in that moment, he starts to question himself. And he, through and through, he's a police officer. And so to go that next step to implicate another police officer, when it push comes to shove, he can't bring himself to do it.
So, yes, and that leaves us, we actually find out who killed Silas at the end and who's responsible. Nefarious characters, the lot of them, so we can't really worry too much. But you can, the listener can discover who is informing on whom, who killed Silas, and whether it was justified or not, and find out more about that code of silence in Christine Gregory's latest novel, The Informant, and it is released by Ultimo Press. So thank you very much, Christine, for talking with
me
today.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Lisa.
So, yeah, we are a done deal today, I believe.
And we had better get out of here and let Resident Frequency Radio come in. Have you put up Resident Frequency on?
I have, thank you.
Wonderful. Oh, that's great. So we'll go to one of their tunes.
So thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next week.